From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. We're broadcasting from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C. For much of this week, the world's attention has been riveted on the rescue of the trapped Chilean miners. In today's news environment, it is so refreshing to have a story this dramatic have a happy ending. We rejoice with the people of Chile. Unfortunately, other life or death dramas are far from being resolved.
It gets better. However bad it is now, it gets better. And it can get great, and it can get awesome. Your life can be amazing, but you have to tough this period of it out, and you have to live your life so that you're around for it to get amazing, and it can and it will.
That's writer and activist Dan Savage in a video designed to inspire hope in isolated and endangered LGBT young people. It's part of an online effort called It Gets Better. That's the project's name, It Gets Better, which Dan launched in response to the recent surge in suicides among self-identified sexual minority youth. Dan Savage will be joining us on this week's State of Belief Radio.
They would bring in this young man's mother. He would take an axe and cut her head off. They have to put the purposes of the Red Guard ahead of their father, mother, brother, sister, and their own life. That was a covenant, a pledge. That's what Jesus said.
Oh, those are the chilling words of Doug Coe, longtime leader of the secretive organization, variously known as the Family, the Fellowship, and International Christian Leadership. Jeff Charlotte, the best-selling author of The Family, has a new book out, C Street, The Fundamentalist Threat to American Democracy. And Jeff will be joining us to dig deeper into this story of corruption and the unrelenting pursuit of power under the guise of adherence to religious truths.
Religious leaders and the Interfaith Alliance of Iowa say an anti-gay marriage effort has shady funding.
The Interfaith Alliance wants Iowans to know who's funding an effort to unseat three Iowa Supreme Court justices.
He's being paid for by a group that perpetuates hate.
In Iowa this past week, activists gathered to condemn politicization of the judiciary, actually jerking from the bench certain judges because of their votes on one issue, same-gender marriage. We'll get an update on that situation from Interfaith Alliance Iowa Executive Director Connie Ryan Terrell. But first, a man true to his word, Greg LaBelle, has slogged through the messy, messy Washington, and the weather's bad, too. Greg is assistant professor of political management and director of the Semester in Washington program at the George Washington University. He's also a veteran of several presidential campaigns. And the last time he appeared on State of Belief Radio several weeks ago, I promised to ask him, what's going to happen this November? So, Greg, welcome.
Thank you.
What's going to happen this November?
Watch me avoid this question. We are going to see some major changes. There's no question about that. I think that if I were a betting man right now, I would bet on the Senate staying in Democratic control. And again, if I were a betting man, I would probably have to go with the House changing hands. And I say that on the strength of some polling data that I've been watching the last couple of days. And there are 40 House seats that are listed right now in most of the polls as toss-ups. 37 of those are currently held by Democrats.
Have you ever seen a midterm election season like this one?
Probably the closest this comes to really has to be 1974 after the Nixon reelect. There was a huge turnover in the other direction in 1974.
Have you ever seen as many people running for office that seem incompetent to hold office?
No, I think we've got that one locked up this time.
I mean, it's not that it's the brightest people in the world already here.
That's true.
But there are some that are distinguishing themselves as being unprepared for public office.
Yeah, and I think we saw another stunning example of that the other night with the Senate debate in Delaware. What I'm calling her Sarah Palin moment. Christine O'Donnell who has been making a big deal about how she disagrees with much of what the Supreme Court has done in the past. When asked to name a specific Supreme Court case that she had a problem with, there was a very long moment of stunned deer in the headlights silence, mm-hmm. and I think that says quite a bit.
Does it seem like to you, it does to me, that there's a backlash to just the discussion of issues? Best example of that may be this week's ruling on the constitutionality of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Here you've got the Obama administration saying that they favor what this would put in place, and yet they're going to appeal it, and progressives are going to feel betrayed, the right scoring points with their base by feeding outrage at the judge's decision. What in the world's going on?
This whole thing with Don't Ask, Don't Tell has become such a quagmire that it's almost impossible to sort it all out. I think that, as I understand it, the administration's position is that this is about precedent from their perspective. They don't want to have a major change in policy like this to be the result of one federal court judge.
Well, Greg, you've been in this town a whole lot longer than I have and understand it much better than I ever will. But is there a principle that you can say anything that you want to say one time, and if you ever don't stand by that or contradict it, nobody ever mentions it? I mean, I'm thinking about this whole discussion on the TARP and the bailout program. There was a day when Congressman Boehner, the Republican leader, was begging his colleagues to support the bailout program because President Bush had proposed the bailout program. And now then, they're having a fit over the fact that Obama had the bailout program in place. I mean, do you just not have to be accountable to what you said?
Well, if there is a principle here, if that's the right word, it is the belief that American voters have very short memories. And I think that in many cases that's proven to be true.
You know, I feel comfortable talking a lot about this because I know so little about it. But the fact is, as I see it, that the bailout program worked. We would be in a far bigger mess right now had that not happened. But everybody's saying it didn't work.
Yeah, well, not everybody. I think that certainly on the Republican side, they're saying that it didn't work. And yeah, it's true. I think you ask any economist in the country with any kind of credibility, and they'll say that what we have gone through, the bailout package and so on and so forth, have prevented us from being in much deeper trouble than we're in. Unfortunately, that's just not good enough. We have this sort of sitcom approach to politics and policy in this country. If it isn't fixed within a 28-minute cycle with allowing for commercials in between, then there's something wrong. Yeah. We were on, and we all recognized at the time, we were on the verge of great economic disaster not that long ago.
Greg, we hadn't mentioned the Tea Party this week, and
no.
I feel like we just got to mention it, so we've mentioned it. Is there anything noticeable about the Tea Party for over the last few days?
In the context of the Tea Party, what we're watching to see how it unfolds is the interest level that's been ginned up by the Tea Party movement versus the Democratic Party's ability to reach out and energize its own base. And the president and the first lady are out there mm-hmm. working it hard now. And I think the fact that the first lady's out there, I think, is significant. She's considerably more popular than the president right now. And this is not something she has done since the president was running for election. That's where it's going to be decided. I think a good example is Nevada, speaking of Tea Party. Mm-hmm. I think this is going to come down to the Tea Party movement and its backing of Sharon Angle and Harry Reid's ability to mobilize that base and to get some interest in those in that Democratic base.
You do it every time, Greg. Great points, good counsel. Thanks for sharing all of that with those of us on State of Belief Radio.
Thanks, Welton.
I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio. Still ahead on this week's show, It Gets Better Project founder, writer, and activist Dan Savage on his work to prevent gay youth suicide. And we'll check in with Interfaith Alliance Iowa Executive Director Connie Ryan Terrell on efforts to protect that state judiciary from far-right religious and political activists. But up next, best-selling author Jeff Charlotte will join us to talk about his new book, another blockbuster, C Street, The Fundamentalist Threat to American Democracy. You don't want to miss this one. It's a great privilege to have him here. So stay tuned to State of Belief Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome back to State of Belief, everybody. I'm Welton Gaddy. State of Belief Radio listeners know our next guest very well. Writer Jeff Charlotte explored the shadowy world of conservative religious influence on power and politics in his best-selling book, The Family. He's a contributing editor for Harper's Magazine and Rolling Stone. Jeff is co-author of Killing the Buddha and is an assistant professor of English at Dartmouth College. I am so pleased to welcome him back to State of Belief Radio. Jeff, welcome.
Well, good to be with you again.
One of the points that you make in your book, C Street, The Fundamentalist Threat to American Democracy, is how notoriously difficult it's been for this story to capture the attention of journalists, how for over 50 years, occasional stories failed to get any traction. So it's particularly impressive that your last book, The Family, was on the New York Times bestseller list for 26 weeks. What did that?
Sex. Sex, the great engine of responsible journalism in America. But, you know, the C Street scandals, of course. We've talked about Senator John Ensign, Governor Mark Sanford, former Congressman Chip Pickering, all connected to the C Street House maintained by the family to guide congressmen in their jobs and also provide them subsidized rent to their tax-exempt status as a church.
You point out how when these guys pray, they insist on calling God coach, and they are just hung up on metaphors that relate to violence. What's that all about?
Well, yeah, I shouldn't say they all insist on calling him coach, but first time I visited C Street, sitting in with a number of congressmen, and they kept on referring to God as coach, and you know that's just kind of a sports metaphor. But then I, you know, sat in on a spiritual counseling session for Congressman Todd Tehart, and it was being led by a man named Doug Coe, the longtime leader of this organization. Many know him as, have experienced him as a warm and charismatic man, as he is. But, you know, let's pay attention not to the personality, but to the politics, the ideas, the theology. What he was describing was a different kind of metaphor. He said the best way to understand Jesus is by looking at the kind of the leadership of guys like Hitler and Stalin and Mao. So we can see he's ideologically tolerant, neither fascist nor communist. The common denominator there is strength. They understand Jesus as this model of total strength, what the group at one point called totalitarianism for Christ. That metaphor, and it is a metaphor, and they're not neo-Nazis or anything like this, but that metaphor leads them into a radically different interpretation of the gospel than I think most Christians have, and it leads them into political alliances. Again, especially overseas, with leaders who exemplify that kind of strength and even leads them right at home to this kind of loyalty, unquestioning loyalty to their own members. So you get a guy like Senator Ensign messing around on his wife. C Street became the vehicle by which he covered it up and did so with so many violations, not just of ethics, but of law, that is now the subject of a Justice Department investigation.
You know, the totalitarian for Christ works if you literally, and I'm not trying to be funny here, if you literally see yourself as the body of Christ, then you're the totalitarian leader.
Well, you know, one of the things I get at in this new book, I'm writing a new book, I spent a lot of time on Uganda and their involvement there and the most draconian anti-gay initiative, but I wanted to understand, you know, the Americans didn't go there trying to spark genocide or anything like that. They went with good intentions. And I was looking at the early documents from the beginning of the relationship with this current regime, and they're describing the body of Christ and thinking of the body of Christ. And what was startling about it to me is that the head of the body of the Christ in these documents, it wasn't Christ. It was Doug Coe, the leader of the group. They referred to him as the head of the body of Christ.
Mm-hmm. You've mentioned the scandals. You've mentioned the attraction to power. You've mentioned the totalitarians for Christ kind of thing. Where do the scandals and the Christ meet in here? And is it just a bipolar situation in which neither end of the polarity looks at the other? Or how do they reconcile that?
No, it's not bipolar at all. You know, I say C Street is the address at which piety and corruption converge, where piety and corruption are one and the same. And I mean that as no disrespect to real piety, but this is a place where what most of us would look at as corruption, certainly the Justice Department is now looking at as corruption, is experienced as piety. One important thing to understand about C Street, the family, the politicians connected to it, they don't think they're doing anything wrong. There's no conspiracy here because they're not sitting around in back rooms thinking about breaking the laws. They think they're doing the right thing. When Senator Tom Coburn, Republican from Oklahoma, lives at C Street, when he was arranging payments to Senator Ensign's mistress's family, he thought he was doing this out of love for his brother, Senator John Ensign. He was being loyal to Senator Ensign. And, you know, they've lost hold of the idea that, you know, beyond religion, you're a U.S. senator. You have other commitments to the American people. Your loyalty to your brother in Christ and your brother in the conservative end of the Republican Party ought to be trumped by your loyalty to the rule of law.
Make sure you join us for next week's edition of State of Belief Radio. We will play part two of my conversation with Jeff Charlotte, author of the best-selling book, The Family. His new book is C Street, The Fundamentalist Threat to American Democracy. There's still lots more to come on this week's show. What's the fallout from the Iowa same-gender marriage court decision? It's pretty brutal, to tell you the truth. And it involves players from way outside the state of Iowa. We'll hear from Interfaith Alliance Iowa Executive Director Connie Ryan Terrell. And up next, the founder of the It Gets Better Project, a video website to support gay youth, outspoken writer and activist Dan Savage. This is State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. See you in a minute. Welcome back. This is State of Belief Radio. I'm Welton Getty. It's impossible to scientifically prove that the relentless messages coming from the far right this election season targeting those among us who are different, be it Muslims or lesbians and gays or other minorities, directly damage individual members of those groups. But there can't be any denying that at the same time as rhetoric that underscores the differences among us heats up, instances of bullying and violence against members of particular minorities, and additionally, in the case of young gay kids, violence against themselves in the form of suicide seems to be sharply increasing. It's important to challenge these divisive messages on principle. But in the struggle to reduce the hopelessness that seems to pervade the lives of some young people who see themselves as different, it's just as important to offer hope in the form of role models. And that's just what writer and activist Dan Savage has done. And he's done it on the internet, a medium most likely to reach isolated and vulnerable young people. The video website is called itgetsbetterproject.com. Dan posted a video in which he and his husband Terry shared some of the challenges they faced while growing up, as well as the simple fact that it got better. Since its launch, the video channel has added hundreds of videos with that singular message. People of various ages and backgrounds have posted, ranging from a 16-year-old girl in Texas to Reverend Gene Robinson, Episcopal Bishop of New Hampshire. Dan Savage, thanks for joining us on State of Belief.
Thank you for having me.
You grew up in a very Roman Catholic environment. I grew up in a very Southern Baptist environment. I know the tragic role that religion can play in creating prejudice and even sometimes inspiring violence. What role do you see for religion to play in helping stop this epidemic of bullying and self-hatred among LGBT youth?
Well, I think that, you know, the public and modern base of Christianity has really been hijacked by the religious right. There's a reason why increasing numbers of people tell pollsters that they have no religious belief and that they're unaffiliated. And when pollsters pry into those numbers, what they discover is that a lot of people who are nominally Christian or actually Christian don't want to publicly identify as Christian when they're asked, because what that now means in America is that you are anti-gay. And moderate and liberal and progressive and accepting and welcoming, even accepting and welcoming religious people who, you know, don't necessarily approve but can see their way clear to gays and lesbians having all the same rights, civil rights, that all other groups have, including other people who do things you think might be sinful. Those people need to speak up, and those people need to be as aggressive and as loud and vocal as the religious right has been.
Dan, what inspired you to create the It Gets Better project?
Well, I heard of the suicide of Justin Auberg in Minnesota, and shortly thereafter the suicide of Billy Lucas in Greensburg, Indiana. And I thought what so many gay adults think when we hear these stories, which is just, I wish I could have spoken to Billy for 10 minutes just to be able to tell him that it gets better. But I was aware that I would never be invited to a school to speak to student body, or invited by, you know, Billy Lucas's parents or the parents of a closeted teenager to speak to their kids, or certainly by churches to come in and speak about homophobia or what it means to be a gay adult. And then it just occurred to me that I was waiting for permission that in the era of YouTube and Facebook and Twitter, I didn't need anymore. And that if need be, I could go over the heads of the parents of bullied gay teenagers and their religious leaders, quote unquote, and their homophobic school administrators, and speak directly to them using YouTube. And obviously I wasn't the only gay or lesbian or bi or trans person who felt that way, because the minute I gave myself permission to go online and talk to them, thousands of other gays and lesbians seized the opportunity, jumped online to share their stories and advice about how to make it better and coping strategies for being bullied, and really practical advice and etiquette about what to do to share with these kids. And what's happening is gay and lesbian adults are no longer willing to wait for permission to talk to gay and lesbian teenagers about their plight.
Dan, you recognize, as do most people, bigotry when you see it or when you hear it. It's shocking. But from your writing, it's pretty clear you feel strongly that a claim from someone like New York gubernatorial candidate Carl Paladino that he takes a live and let live stand may actually be more damaging. Talk about that for a second.
It's not his live and let live stand. That was his apologia after he said some insanely bigoted things in front of television cameras, that we shouldn't tolerate homosexuality, which means exactly what then in the lives of gay and lesbian teenagers and middle schoolers? If, you know, they hear their parents and they hear their preachers saying we shouldn't tolerate homosexuality, well, how are those kids who are straight going to treat the gay kid at their school when they hear they're not supposed to tolerate homosexuality, when they hear that gay and lesbian people are a threat to their family, a threat to the institution of marriage, and then they go to school and there's the gay teenager? That's the damage that's going on out in the boonies and the exurbs, places dominated by conservative politics, conservative religious groups. Is, you know, there aren't gay and lesbian adults in Greensburg, Indiana, really, for straight people to abuse. So mom and dad may abuse gay people at the ballot box, but then their kids can go to school, and there's a gay 13-year-old. And Tony Perkins would have us believe, and the religious right would have us believe, that, you know, Asher Brown in Texas could have he chose to be gay, and he could have chosen very easily to be straight, but 13-year-old Asher Brown chose to be gay, and then it was easier for Asher Brown to choose to put a bullet in his head than to just choose to be straight again. Mm-hmm. And it's that kind of bigotry that really Paladino was validating and perpetuating in his speech.
You're working very hard on something that a lot of people are just talking about a lot, and that is to be respected and affirmed. Do you see hope, or do you feel more despair? What is your perspective?
I see a lot of hope. You know, we put these videos up, and our first worry was ours would be the only one. And then hundreds and hundreds of videos started pouring in, and hundreds of emails and comments of support. And then our worry was it was just going to be adults talking to each other, and the videos wouldn't be reaching the kids who needed to see them. And then we started getting the emails from bullied, gay, lesbian, bi, trans, even straight teenagers who were taking hope from these videos. And a lot of kids who are bullied for being gay aren't gay. They're just perceived to be gay, or gay is the, you know, term of abuse, term of art for abusing kids in school. And then we started getting emails from the parents of bullied 13, 14-year-old gay, lesbian, bi, and trans kids saying that they were sitting down at the computer with their children together to watch these videos, and it was helping. And it was helping their kids who'd been in despair maybe not solve the problem of bullying in their school overnight. You know, we need GSAs. We need anti-bullying programs. We need prosecution. Three kids assaulted a gay 14-year-old in a high school on Long Island, mm-hmm. and they were arrested. And that is what should happen. When one of them is 18 years old. An 18-year-old goes to a shopping mall and beats up an old lady. He goes to prison. Mm-hmm. Why is it that when an 18-year-old goes to a middle school and beats up a 13-year-old, he doesn't get suspended? Mm-hmm. And so I am very hopeful that we are seeing change. I am very hopeful now that people's awarenesses are being raised, also that these videos are getting to the kids who need to see them. And what they need to know is that the lies they've been told about what it is to be gay aren't true. They've been told that being gay means, you know, your family will reject you, that you will never have a life, never have a family of your own, that you will be unhappy all your life, and that you won't find a faith tradition that necessarily embraces you. And all of those lies are disproved with these videos. And a kid who's had nothing but lies hammered into his head about what it means to be gay, lesbian, bi, or trans can spend literally 15 minutes watching videos and have all those lies disproved, not just because an adult said so, but because all these adults are showing it. They're sharing their lives, showing their stories to these kids, and it disproves all the lies that these kids have been told about themselves.
Dan, I want to thank you for what you're doing. I want to thank you for taking time to talk with us today on State of Belief Radio. Keep up the good work.
I will do. You too. Thank you for helping to get the word out, particularly to people who need to hear it. You know, there's a lot of parents out there who have, you know, firmly held convictions and, you know, faith, who need to know that they can't bully their gay kids out of being gay or terrorize them out of being gay. And the choice isn't between often having a straight kid or a gay, you know, or a gay mm-hmm. kid. The choice, if you're going to bully your kid often, too often, is between a gay kid and a dead kid. And you need to support your kid, whoever your kid is.
Dan Savage, together with his husband Terry, have launched ItGetsBetterProject.com, a video website that allows individuals to share encouraging words of hope with young LGBT people who may be struggling with the potentially life-threatening issue of self-worth and hopelessness. We have a link to the site available on stateofbelief.com. Dan, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Up next, Iowa has become a battleground over same-gender marriage, and the judges who rule that this is a constitutional rights issue are in the crosshairs this election season. We're going to get a briefing from Interfaith Alliance Iowa Executive Director Connie Ryan Terrell. Stay tuned. You'll want to hear it. We'll be right back. This is State of Belief Radio. Welcome back, everybody, to State of Belief. I'm Welton Gaddy. Across the nation, Americans committed to religious liberty are working to facilitate interfaith dialogue and to promote the separation of church and state, so integral to the functioning of our democracy. Nationwide, local chapters of Interfaith Alliance are a vital part of that work. And this week, Interfaith Alliance Iowa stepped up to the front lines to loudly rebuke opportunistic meddling from out-of-state interests who working to exploit the controversy around Iowa's same-gender marriage ruling this election season. Now, I can tell you how serious it is. They're sending in former Judge Roy Moore, who's made everybody mad in almost every state in the nation with his vitriol and opposition to church-state separation. So they've got their hands full. With me right now is Interfaith Alliance Iowa Executive Director Connie Ryan Terrell. She's a bit fatigued from the work, but Connie, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much, Welton, for the opportunity.
You held two press conferences earlier this past week. What was the message?
we really wanted Iowans to understand what was going on in the state, and particularly related to an organization that has popped up that is intended to oust three of our Supreme Court justices. You know, we had a ruling in Iowa a year and a half ago now that now allows for same-gender marriage in our state. And as an organization, we're very pleased with that ruling. And that ruling was a unanimous decision, and it was constitutionally based. And this group, headed by a man by the name of Bob Vanderplas, who's run for governor three times and lost, has decided to start this campaign against the justices to unseat them. And behind the scenes of that, he is being funded by the hate group American Family Association, which says all kinds of crazy things against people who are gay and lesbian, Muslim, immigrants, you know, you name it. And American Family Association is funding the effort by Bob Vanderplas and his named organization, Iowa for Freedom.
Connie, the reason that people are focusing on those three judges is because of the ruling on same-gender marriage?
That's what they're saying, and they're saying a lot of things that are incorrect and misleading to the public. But we in Iowa have a marvelous system of appointing and retaining our judges. We do not elect our judges as they do in some states. It's not a partisan position. It's not a political position. Judges are appointed, and then there is a vote of retention every so often for judges at all levels. And so these three judges just happen to be up for retention. It includes our Chief Justice, unfortunately. And so we're not telling people how to vote, but we are asking people to become educated on what's happening, and particularly what's behind the organization that is opposed to these justices.
Do you see Iowans realizing that they're being used by outside forces?
It really has become an interesting conversation, and people are beginning to wake up and understand, you know, we've never ousted a Supreme Court justice in this retention process. Only four judges in the entire state in the history of our retention process have been removed through that process, and that has been in place since 1962. And so it has been used, but it's been used, pardon the phrase, but judiciously.
Mm-hmm.
And so people are starting to understand that they need to pay attention, and they need to become educated on what's happening.
Someone listening to this conversation says, oh, but that's in Iowa. Is there a lesson here for everybody committed to religious liberty?
Yes, there absolutely is. We fully believe that this is just testing ground for other states, and that if they win in Iowa and are able to oust somebody from the court based on one single decision, which should never be the case, they will continue to wreak havoc on the courts across the country.
Connie, thanks for briefing us on the work of Interfaith Alliance Iowa on this really important issue. I wish you success, and we're going to keep an eye on the story to be sure. We've been talking to Interfaith Alliance Iowa Executive Director Connie Ryan Terrell. She's a great leader there, and they are doing their best in a tough situation. This is State of Belief Radio. Connie, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much, Welton. Good luck to you as well.
And a final note. Mormons are Christians. I know that. You know that. But I didn't say what I know recently on this show. 2 weeks ago, State of Belief Radio summarized some of the findings of the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life U.S. Religious Knowledge Survey. The survey results turned out to be the most blogged topic of that week, and we summarized some highlights on this show. In extrapolating data and grouping participants, I inadvertently listed the Mormon faith under the heading non-Christians. I'm grateful to the listeners who brought this mistake to my attention. This show generally, and I personally, strive every day to be responsible and respectful as we present the tapestry of different faith traditions, hoping that we will seek common ground and explore what we can learn from each other. The cornerstone of this pursuit must be careful and accurate characterization of those traditions, and it is never our intention to misrepresent any faith. It was not my intention to misrepresent the Mormon faith. Mormons are Christians, and it was an editing error, not a lack of understanding, that led to this misstatement. But I apologize. I apologize, and I promise you, we'll do better. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's edition of State of Belief Radio. Visit us online at stateofbelief.com to find out more about the show. Listen to our show's archives and sign up for our podcast. That's stateofbelief.com. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Let me tell you something. There's not been a time in recent memory when the cause of religious liberty needed more support. We need you. Join us today. Become a member of Interfaith Alliance. Go to interfaithalliance.org to learn more. We'll be right back here on State of Belief Radio next week with more stories. I've already told you a little bit about what's coming next week, but there'll be more stories from the intersection of religion and politics, probably some surprises as well. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was.